I thought I would like to do a little work. I'm not going to ask you to do any singing this morning, so if you're worried about that, please don't. It's too early in the day. You know, we have choir at 10:30. Oh, I always feel badly about Easter Sunday morning and that early service. Oh, and if you feel bad about it, you ought to be in the choir. You know, I'll never forget coming at 5:30 and everybody, we had to have coffee around, everybody could sing and all of that. My concern and the reason I want to talk about the Red Book this morning is just that I think there is so much more there that has been untapped that I would like to this morning call your attention to a few things, and perhaps from that, either or hopefully both, one, you might be inspired in your own personal life to make use of some materials that you would find there, and even further, that you might be able to take some of these ideas back to your own church, above your choir director, a friendly word for the minister, you know, the whole routine. And I firmly believe, you know, I mean, if you do it in the right way, you know, you may have to do it 20 times, but you'll get it through. I think the Red Book is certainly one of the better hymnals in America today. I don't say that it's the best, but I think it's an awfully good one, because a lot of concern went into it, and we'll talk about that a little later on. Hymn books have been around, as you may or may not know, for a long, long time. The music formerly, when I say formerly, I mean say pre-Reformation times, was mostly done not by the congregation. So at that point, anything that the congregation learned, and of course before the invention of the printing press, the songs that came around were those that had repeats to them, where somebody would sing it and then you'd have the repeat that would make itself known. For instance, carols like the First Noel, which is very, very old. The 19th century was I'm getting ahead of myself. The 19th century in music was awful because it took all the bumps out of music. It smoothed everything over and made everything seem the same. What you sing as the First Noel was not what was written at all. It was quite different. And it was nice because it was much more angular. It didn't go so sweetly, you know. And this is true of a lot of music. One of the worst people of all was John Bacchus Dykes, who wrote Holy, Holy, Holy and a bunch of other things. And he was very instrumental in smoothing over all the bumps. Consequently, since people couldn't read, they would have to do things like, for instance, this very old one, which might get sung by a small group, and then the congregation would respond when you got to the refrain, and a small quartet or a soloist or something would go, you know, and back and forth, and you get to the, you know, and all the way through all those alleluias, one person and then the congregation. Well, that was easy to do because they just simply copied what happened. And that kind of refrain sort of approach was the way music was done until they actually could, you know, hold it up in front of them and read. Well, then started, you know, into the whole bit of the hymn book. Certainly a lot of the texts and our great first source is the Book of Common Prayer, which, you know, if you've never looked at an English Book of Common Prayer, you just ought to. I mean, it's just wonderful. It should be one of the required pieces of reading. It's just a great, great source textbook. And hymn books then, you know, gradually came into being as people started to take much more interest and became more involved as a worshiping congregation and had something to do in the service. Now, some of the hymn books, of course, at first were very, very narrow. That is, that they approached only, say, the chorales. Maybe it was only a chorale. It depended on where you lived and what kind of thing. And it wasn't really until into the 20th century that you started to have these broad kind of hymn books that appealed to a great number of people and could be, you know, like the Lutheran one, could be used by German congregations, Swedish, Finnish. You get a much more broad picture. It's not easy to come up with that hymnal, and you never please everybody when you do it. But it does make a wealth of tunes more widely available. And certainly in the actual hymn book, you do find that people who use a wider hymn book have that much greater a scope from which to choose. I don't know what it is like in your church, but I suppose if you took the bulletins for the last year and jotted down the hymn numbers that you've sung, it's probably quite small, or the repeats are quite large, rather. You know, it depends. And there are, you know, you get down to about a handful of, say, two dozen hymns, you know, the old standbys. When all else fails, you grab Holy, Holy, Holy for processional and you're on your way. It always hurts me to think of a congregation using the same hymn for processional every Sunday, because they've only got three as it is, and one's already wiped out. And so you only have two hymns a Sunday that ever change. There's so many hymns that can work processionally that that little point always seems to bother me. But the actual hymnal that we have, the Lutheran one, was, as I say, a compilation of various backgrounds brought together. In the beginning of the hymnal, if you'll just look, you'll notice that before the hymns actually begin, there's a whole source of material. There's some interesting introductory words that probably most of you have never read, which is kind of fascinating, about the origin of how the service actually came to be. And after you've gone through that section, then you'll find matter related to the service. You'll have the collects and the gradual. One of the areas, this will sort of, I'll do good and bad points as we go through. One of the areas I think that this hymnal fell down on is the graduals. Those gradual texts are just wonderful, but those Harold Gilbert settings are so difficult for the average congregation that they don't ever use them. And it would really be nice if there was a spiffy set so that after you had finished the epistle for the day, I don't know what page they're on, but let me grab a handle here. They start on page 117, but you'll notice even earlier, all the way through, you have with each of the Sundays, you notice starting around page 80 or a little earlier, you have your introit and your collect and your gradual. The gradual each Sunday varies, and there's such wonderful texts that don't appear in any other part of the hymnal that it's always kind of a shame. Here we are, for instance, this week, let's take this Sunday. Here we are on the eighth Sunday after Trinity, over on page 98, the ninth Sunday. No, yeah, I'm on the wrong page. Yes, it's the ninth Sunday. And here's that wonderful gradual, O Lord our Lord, from Psalm 8, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, who has set thy glory above the heavens. And these great texts, it would, to me, be really a wonderful, even if it was just spoken, if after the epistle has been read, much as the Alleluia is wonderful and lovely, to instead of that, have this chance where everybody in the congregation together recited this text from the Psalms, which would change each week. I'm glad that there's something like the Gilbert in here, but they're so difficult. I tried them in one Lutheran church one time, and you know, it was just a mess, and it just didn't work. I mean, it put people against it, and consequently, then you had to immediately change, because if people are fighting it, then there's no sense. It's like trying to institute a hymn of the month routine if your church has tried one. If you don't do it the right way, and the minister's against it, drop it and just wait a few years and try it again in another way. You maybe didn't go about it right. But I've seen that happen, and it's just turned people sour. Sometimes because the first hymn that was chosen is, you know, a choir director will say, well, since we've never had one, let's start out with a real winner and let's get it at it. And it's some hymn that's just really hard to sing. And, you know, you lose them all, and you get that impression if you're a churchgoer. If this is the hymn for this month, where's it going to be next month? You know, kind of routine. Well, that's kind of unfortunate, but it often happens. And so you have to be careful in how you present material that way, too. But anyway, the graduals, to me, are one of the really unsung heroes of the opening part of the book. And then you go beyond that, and you have the matins and the vespers. In addition to the matins and vespers, though, you might just keep your finger around page 140 or where we are now. And then you notice way over on at the end of that, there's the various canticles for the day that come the antiphons, the responsories, around 149 to 151. Again, some wonderful little verses that for seasonal use are just really marvelous. The instructions come later on in the hymn book, so that if you wonder where to put them in, it's all there. It's just a matter of, it may not have been laid out as carefully in this part as it could have been. And then you go on from there, and you have the various services. You have the suffrages and the litany. One of the nicest uses of the litany, by the way, the litany appears on just before the psalm start on page 156. That is a long, long litany. I heard it used in a church as during the Sundays in Lent as the processional, as the minister walked through the congregation reciting his part and the congregation. That's how the service opened, with the litany. It was very meaningful, much more than if the minister stood in the front of the church and for 5 minutes went through the whole litany. Then people started to become. But it became very much more personal because the minister was among the people saying this as he walked through the congregation. And gradually, then when he came to the front of the church, at the end of it, then came the opening hymn. And it was, I thought, a much well-defined use of the litany for the Sundays in Lent, and it put it on a much higher plane. The problem with a lot of these service parts of the service become, or these settings in the service, are that so often if they're not done, they can be done boringly or they can be done inspiringly. And it's when they're done boringly that you have to wait 2 years to try them again. You do them once inspiringly, and you've just got people ready to, well, let's try another one, and they will. Then come the psalms. I don't know, since they put, three-fourths of the psalms in, I don't know why they didn't put them all, but anyway, they didn't. Then come those wonderful canticles, which are starting on page 215, which ought to be inserted into matins and vesper services, and could be, and should be. Then come the prayers and the occasional services. And then comes a section which ought to sort of be not necessarily a rule for membership, but it would be kind of nice if everybody was aware of page 274. I start, all apologies for ignorance, but I honestly, truly thought that it was a required course at all seminaries for ministerial students to have a course in music. And I found out that wasn't true when I went to teach. I went and taught a session at a seminary in Minneapolis, and I just thought I didn't know what to teach. I said, but you already have had all this. No, we haven't. I said, but the music's such a big part of the service, you can't omit it. Well, there were other things to teach. And I said, yeah, I know, but hell, And so I don't blame ministers, but they need all the help they can get, too. I speak from the background that my father was at an Evangelical United Brethren, which is now merged with the Methodist Church, and could, his singing, he was a very wise man who always backed up from the microphone whenever any singing was done, and I appreciated that. But at the same time, he admitted, he didn't know, and he would always turn for assistance to other people. He had a good sense about saying, no, wait a minute, if someone was going too far. But at the same time, he often would say, I really don't know about, does this kind of hymn work at this particular point? And, for instance, you will once and for all know, if you look on page 277, when Easter comes. Everybody's always, when does Easter fall this year? And it's all spelled out for you there, right down at the bottom of the page. Did you know that Easter is always the first Sunday after the full moon, which happens upon or next after the 21st day of March? There, you will always know that. Every year, it's Easter. And what's, of course, very nice about the book is that a couple of pages later, there's an Easter table on page 2878, and it'll take you until the year 2002. And I think for the present, that's all we have to worry about. There it is. It's wonderful. It's all taken care of for you. That, to me, that little section from 274 up to well, up into the early 280s, because it provides some wonderful devotional material, is really the most unknown part of the book. And it's really a shame, because that's really where the source of it all is. Unfortunately, it's stuck in the middle. It should be at the beginning, where you would have seen it right off. But it kind of happens right there. Look it over sometime. You'd be amazed. You know, if you serve on an altar guild, and you never know what color to have the vestments and what color to have the cause, it's all there. Tells you when it changes, what it, you know, sometimes it changes within the middle of another color. It's all there, all taken care of. And some of it's, the language is a little dense, but, you know, it's all there for you to use. And I think ending with those psalm paraphrases on 284, you've got, you know, you've virtually got the whole thing taken care of. I think also, before we move on into the next part of the book, you'll find that the service that is there, they of course admit that there ought to be more services. They point out the differences between the first and second setting. It's not just a matter of two settings. They were approached from two entirely different ways. And of course they mentioned that unfortunately there wasn't room for a third setting, which was going to be a medieval one, which is really too bad, because that would really be nice to have. We're going to do a medieval vespers on Wednesday night here, which I'm really looking forward to. I don't think the village has ever done one. And it's kind of fascinating when you have to use entirely for your vespers only materials available from the time of Columbus and earlier, how much there already is here. We don't have to go anywhere else. It's all there to use. We won't use the organ, but then they wouldn't have used one either. I mean, you know, can you imagine what that first Sunday must have been like in a church when they had an organ? Be like, you know, bringing in today a Moog synthesizer. Be the same thing. And again, you know, how you introduce these things. We did a piece at Plymouth. I'm at Plymouth Congregational in Minneapolis, and we did a piece a couple of years ago, the first time I'd ever done a piece with electronic tape in the morning service. And I do feel that, you know, service is, in addition to all of the other things it is, it must also be educational if it's new. You don't simply throw something on people's heads and say, take it, you know, because they'll most times say, thank you very much, I won't. They'll be nice about it, but, you know, they don't want it again. And it was fascinating to go out to the congregation and say something about an electronic tape piece and compare it. You know, if you can just get them to, they don't understand, you know, most people, what's an electronic tape piece? That doesn't mean anything to people. They've never heard. You know, they've heard it on a television show, but they didn't know that's what it was. It's like how many people, I'm amazed at how many people, when they hear that, you know, there used to be an ad, at least in the Midwest, for Crystal Sugar, that went, you know, a little thing like that. It was all played on a celeste. And a celeste is an instrument much like a piano, that it's but there are no strings, there are all metal bars inside, and there are little hammers that hit them. It's the same instrument Tchaikovsky used after he went to Paris and got back to Russia. Well, people are just amazed to all of a sudden to find out that that little instrument, you know, yeah, I never knew what that instrument was. Well, it's the same little celeste that, you know, Tchaikovsky used. But if you say celeste, they go, huh? You say, Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies. Oh, yeah, I know what that sound is, you know. Right away, they remember it. And it's the same thing here. You don't talk to people about electronic tape music because they don't know what that is. But you, you know, try and make a comparison. And I felt the best one was trying to get them to imagine what church was like without an organ, which none of them had ever experienced. And that incredible shock that a medieval congregation must have felt when all of a sudden, for the first Sunday, oof, you know, here's this thing, you know, good grief. And always before, you know, there was some bell to give pitch, and it was all done a cappella. Well, approaching it that way was fascinating, because then we went and did this tape piece for choir and tape and organ, and it's really a wild piece. And afterward, what was the general response from young, medium, and old? Boy, when are you doing that again? That's really interesting. That's a new way of looking at the that happened to be the text, Come Holy Spirit. Oh, now that's just great, because the tape was the Holy Spirit going all over the place. And everybody was just amazed. Oh my, hey, what a neat way to think of the Holy Spirit. Never thought of it that way before. Never thought of, you know, just fast kind of thing. But had I simply put the tape on and started, I know the response. You know, thank you, Philip. That was lovely. We won't ever have tape again in our service. I know. You know, well, why, you know, since you know that's going to happen, you avoid it by going the other way. And people felt, of course, the young people were just absolutely gassed. The thought of, you know, something like that in the service. And the old people, it was fascinating because they said, you know, I never, you know, it's very easy to think of these things in a very pietistic sense, you know, especially because we used to think of it always as Holy Ghost, you know, and people grew up with that ghost thing, and then they had Casper at the same time, and it was you know, how do you get these two going? And it was fascinating to watch people, watch their response, and we've done the piece since then, and we've done another piece. And, you know, you just, a little germ of education, and they just go, yeah, yeah, come on, they really like it. Well, the same thing happens when you go into the hymnal part of the book. I would never, I may someday be on one, but I would shudder at being involved in working on a new hymnal. Because you start with the wonderful assumption that no one's ever going to be happy. You know, I mean, there's no way. You know, I'm not happy with this book. Oh, I can name you 15 tunes that are missing that should not have missed out of this book. And I can name you 15 that they could have replaced. I've mentioned several already while I've been here. But, you know, it's a really incredibly difficult job. And I think for basic of comparison, the hymnal, and I've mentioned this a couple of times the last couple of weeks, the hymnal that set the pattern for all the hymnals, including this one that exists today, is the 1906 English hymnal. And that was the first really radical hymnal change that had ever happened. And the clergyman assigned to make up that hymnal, that was the hymnal for use by the Church of England, England and Scotland, Episcopal in nature. They said, you know, we had to find somebody who would really be a superb musician, which is nice, to head up the hymnal. And at the same time with someone, the problem always is, you know, is some musician who'd also be sympathetic to the text and not just simply, you know, overlord you with tunes that you couldn't sing and at the same time not be concerned about the text. And they asked Ralph Vaughan Williams. And Vaughan Williams, who died in 1958, was a most unlikely choice. He was a young man at the time, and, you know, it was like Vaughan Williams. He'd been a church organist a couple of years, but his real interest had been in symphonic. He really hadn't gotten known in England, and it seemed like a really screwy idea to have Vaughan Williams be in charge of this enormous project. And Vaughan Williams didn't want the job either, because he said, it'll take me 2 years to do it, and I won't be able to compose another thing. It was true. He said, I don't know that I can take 2 years out of my creative life to do this project. But he did do it, and he said, I'm so glad I did because I learned so much. I learned what not to do in music and what to do. And he says a couple of interesting things that I just want to read you in a biography on him. He was given the job because of his interest in folk song. And those of you who know some of the background of hymnology know that most of the songs that we have, especially in the early ones that have carried on through, are based to a great deal on secular origins. Things like, you know, this one that people oftentimes think so glumly. An old drinking song in the 16th century, you remember it? And this wonderful love song. And this, which is one of the really beautiful love ballads of all time. Sacred Head in the beginning, because they knew it with secular origins. That's why I say, you know, so what's wrong with singing Hark the Herald Angels? Hark the Herald Angels sing. You know, well, it works, you know. Today we would go, oh. And back in the Reformation, there were people who went, oh. But if you're all of a sudden, you've never sung in church and you got to start someplace, you don't start by giving them, here are your 20 new tunes that you've never sung. You know, Well, you know what it's like. You know, this is an unusual place to have new tunes, like when we did He Who Would Valiant Be the other night. You know, you pick it up and people are willing to sing it, but in the home church, you know, it all of a sudden means seclusion. Well, he says, Vaughan Williams says, the truth is that I determined to do the work thoroughly, and that beside being a compendium of all the tunes of worth which were already in use, the book should, and this is the key of why it's so, why it is the textbook, the book should in addition be a thesaurus of all the finest hymn tunes in the world. At all events, all such as were compatible with the meters of the words for which I had to find tunes. It says they checked all texts carefully, often restoring an author's original words where previous editors had substituted tamer or commonplace sentiments. And he goes on a little later and says, I did my best to eliminate the bad ones. This was difficult because I was not entirely my own master. Doesn't sound very good. My committee insisted that certain very popular tunes should be retained. The climax came when my masters declared that I must myself write a fulsome letter to a prominent ecclesiastic asking for leave to print his horrible little tune. My committee and I finally settled our quarrel with a compromise by which the worst offenders were confined in an appendix at the end of the book, which we nicknamed the Chamber of Horrors. I avoided the specially composed tune so far as I could. Of course, in the case of a very peculiar meter, this was impossible. I then had to have recourse to a well-known contemporary composer for choice. And because of that, he oftentimes, if it was an unusual new text, he would ask for a composer in England or somewhere to write a new setting, sometimes doing them himself. That's why one of the tunes that one of the clerics on the committee said ought to definitely be in the new hymnal was the text, For All the Saints Who From Their Labors Rest. And since there wasn't any tune available at that time, Vaughan Williams sat down and wrote. And it was the same way that they came across Christina Rossetti's text in the Bleak Midwinter, and he talked the holes that we got out of that. And there have been several examples that all came out of this particular book. He also composed for that book, if you don't know it, that wonderful hymn that comes in Pentecost season, Come Down, O Love Divine. Beautiful little thing. Beautiful text, too. And anyway, he goes on and on and on. And then he says here at the end, and this is, you know, with this kind of thing going, you couldn't have a bad hymnal entirely. I mean, you know, there's questions even about the English hymnal, but not as many as about other hymnals. He says, the committee believe that many clergymen and organists will welcome a tune book in which enervating tunes are reduced to a minimum. The usual argument in favor of bad music is, this is the argument in favor of bad music, is that the fine tunes are doubtless musically correct, but that the people want something simple. Now, the expression musically correct has no meaning. The only correct music is that which is beautiful and noble. As for simplicity, what could be simpler than St. Anne? It requires a certain effort to tune oneself to the moral atmosphere implied by a fine melody, and it is far easier to dwell in the miasma of the languishing and sentimental hymn tunes which so often disfigure our service. Such poverty of heart may not be uncommon, but at least it should not be encouraged by those who direct the services of the church. It ought no longer to be true anywhere that the most exalted moments of a churchgoer's week are associated with music that would not be tolerated in any place of secular entertainment. Now, Vaughan Williams writes in 1906, when the quality of hymn music was so much lower. I mean, the hymnal that preceded the English hymnal had virtually entirely "What a Friend We Have in Jesus" is kind of hymns. You know, John Bacchus Dyke reigns supreme, and all of these kinds of hymns. You know, I mean, it was, when he speaks back earlier of sentimental hymn tunes, my stars, you know, "Softly and Tenderly" was the rule in that hymnal rather than the exception. And that's not to say that it has nothing to do with the person who composed them, whether they were, you know, indeed as they were, very, very, you know, people who were concerned and who were really writing out of a great desire to add something. But he's speaking of a larger issue here, and one that, even though may not be as big a problem in our day, is still, to some degrees, obviously a problem, as we all have seen. So they put together this hymnal, and they had all kinds of influences, political, that they had to go by. I mean, obviously, if you're going to have a hymnal for all of these groups, you've got to have your hymnal. You know, whether it has nothing to do with the fact that it's of Luther, it has to do with the fact that they're a German congregation. You got to have a Scandinavian one, you know, so the Germans kind of upgrade themselves. Yes, I will include a Scandinavian. Then you've got to have English hymns. You had to have Finnish hymns, or the Finnish Lutheran Church would not buy the hymnal. True. I mean, why should they? If you're not going to include any of our hymns, we'll make up our own. So that's why several ones, like that little one we ended the service with last night, that lovely little thing that's in the pilgrimage section, you remember? Was included, as well as that great hymn, "Arise, My Soul, Arise." And then beyond that, they also went to musical, historical reasons. For instance, if you look at hymn number 7, here's an example of two different tunes. Philip Nicolai, back in the 16th century, wrote the original version. But that kind of version, which is unmetered, is rather difficult for congregations, and not always, but until they get into it, and many people are, this is one of the easier unmetered ones, but some of them become very, very difficult for people to follow. And of course, Bach, as you see by the second tune, simply arranged some of these that were more angular. Now, what ended up happening in the 19th century was that people said, oh, well, Bach is even still too angular, and we'll fix it up even more. You know, it would be like singing, instead of singing "Wake, Awake," you know why that goes that way, don't you? The trumpet call. You notice the words? "Wake, awake, for night is flying." This was an old trumpet call. A trumpet call wouldn't go. Go to sleep. It was obvious why they went that way. Everything is, you know, these things were not done just, you know, I wonder what notes I'll use to start this song. It was very carefully worked out. They knew, wait, there was no other way to go. And it's amazing with the old hymns how often you find when you talk about heaven, you always go up. You always do. You never talk about heaven going zooming down there. You know, never. Unless, the only time would be unless somebody who edited it did a new translation and it didn't work out, so they got heaven way down the hell going way up here, you know. Okay, you know, that goes into that's the music, the editing, you know, how did they know about what they did with the hymnal? This one works out very well, and the translation works equal to the one that Captain Winkworth did, works out very, very well. But these kind of hymns, had the alternate settings put in so that if some would like to have the original, which is not that difficult, you would have it, and it would provide a historical connecting link. They restored number 9, for instance, the Swedish one, to its original lilty 6/8 feeling. I remember it when it was done in the 19th century in a composer who had taken all that swingy out of it. You know, in the Swedish covenant hymn, though, it does not appear this way. It does not go. That kind of nice, welcomey kind of swing, they took that all out and said, no. And here's the way a 19th century person would clean it up, make them all equal. you see, but then you go back and see how much nicer. But that's too clean for church, you see. That's why it was taken out. The lips go down. Now, that is not to say that they're all good. For instance, I'll tell you one of the awful ones. Ernie White did. It's over number 17. Oh. If any church uses the second tune of 17, please stop. You know, that one doesn't work at all. The only tune you can use is the first, which just follows the words. It's such a wonderful chant. And if your congregation is, oh, a chant, can't do a... Meanwhile, they've been doing all those chants in the service settings, right? Yeah, but oh, him, no. This is so easy to do, you know? But get over to that second tune. It's a different kind of tune. I mean, it doesn't work that way. I feel. I mean, there's an example of personal reaction to it. I feel that they goofed when they did that one. Let's just, while we're here, review so that we do all know about our hymns. Say we go over to hymn 15, which everybody knows. It says, melody arranged by Lowell Mason at the top. Believe that this Handel in origin was an adaptation from the Hallelujah Chorus. And the Hallelujah Chorus was an adaptation of Wake, Awake, Your Night Is Fine in certain lines. They all, you know, the borrowing that went on back there, it was all done at very above chorus. The rule was, I have found this wonderful little part of a tune. It's awfully good, and I can improve upon it. And that's what they did. No feeling at all of, you know, sneaking around. It's not like today where, you know, everything's copyrighted, and you know, hell, if you grab somebody's copyright, you're really in trouble. It was just very, very common for people to use all of the things, and to borrow within their own. You know, when Handel wrote Messiah, and it's not the Messiah, but when Handel wrote Messiah, that's like saying, you know, we will now sing Handel's oratorio, the Judas Maccabeus. You know, we wouldn't say that. Or we'll sing Handel's oratorio, the Solomon. No, it's just Solomon, Judas Maccabeus, Messiah. When he wrote it, he said, he had to write it in a very short period of time, 21 days. And so, you know, obviously that wasn't going to all be new music. So he found some other things that he'd written before that were very nice. He had a love duet from an Italian cantata that he'd done very early, which exactly fit metrically to, you know, it fits fine, and why not, you know, it didn't matter at all. And the same way, you know, anybody that sings that one that ends part one of Messiah, his yoke is easy and his burden is light, and sings it, oh, okay, you know, that was another love duet, you know, and it was a real kind of, you know, kind of love duet. You know? I mean, it wasn't any big passion, you know, it was a real, you know, tiptoe through the tulip kind of piece. And that's the way he wanted it, you know, he thought of his yoke is easy. He didn't think of it, oh, okay, you know, and so it's. But not that one. Of course, you know, now we go off to Handel, obviously didn't know English, and that was another routine. He always wrote everything in English with a pencil in one hand and a dictionary in the other. Because he had no idea on the... Because sometimes the accent would fall on the wrong syllable, right? Oh, I got a wonderful example of that. We'll get on to later in the week. So we get to number 15, and what do we have? As we mentioned the other night, anything to do with music is always at the top. Always in this hymn. And if it has to do anything with the words, it's always at the bottom. And if you come up to me and say, oh, you know that wonderful tune, Joy of the World, I will say, do you know? But if you say, do you know that wonderful tune, Antioch, I will say, yes.
And that's the responsibility of organists, to learn to know all the tunes. Because otherwise, as it happens in this hymnal, a tune gets used for sometimes 5 or 6 different sets of words. So when you come to me with it and say, do you know such and such, I'll say, well, what tune do you use? Oh, yeah, well, that's the tune. No, that's the title of the text, but that's not the tune. They are two entirely different things. And as I mentioned the other night, if you're in a church where the titles of preludes are printed, you'll often see prelude on, and then some, and you'll say, well, whatever is that? Well, it's the tune name. And tune names come from anywhere. In the Bleak Midwinter, the tune name is Cranham. And Cranham was the name of the woods right outside of Holt's birthplace. You know that hymn that Leland Saturn wrote for the hymnal, Deep Were His Wounds and Red? He called it Marley, which is one syllable from each of the names of his two sons. Mm-hmm. You know, names of tunes have no piousness at all. I mean, you know, whatever you felt like calling it. You know, you wrote the tune, you can call anything you want. You know, there could be one called Tiptoe Through the Tulips if they wanted. You know, there aren't any, which is kind of too bad. Because we will sing this morning Tiptoe Through the Tulips. But, or Prelude On. I would love that. But they come from anything. They come from names of buildings, churches. I don't know what all of the derivations are, and a lot of them have gone in, you know, into oblivion. No one can tell anymore. But they do come from any kinds of number of ways. Many times they're named for the composer, like, you know, that's never intended to go with Harp and Herald Angels Sing. In fact, Mendelssohn, when he wrote that tune, said it will never do as a hymn. Because what he wrote it for was the 400th anniversary of the printing press. And it was originally to the words, Gutenberg! And so every time I ever sing it, you know, I always go for thousands. But somebody else said, no, it does fit. Obviously it does fit. And, you know, you take it from there and on your way. So they come from any number of ways. Some of the hymns have just wonderful stories behind them. I mean, beautiful ones. Christians Awake to the Half Born was a Christmas gift that was done by John Byron for his wife. And it's just wonderful. I mean, what a wonderful way to wake up on Christmas morning, you know, and hear your husband has written you a new hymn tune for Christmas morning. Well, terrific. Or some of the other ones that were written that, like, Beneath the Cross of Jesus was written by a lady who died at age 38 as the last thing before she died. That's another one that gets a little over-sentimentalized, but that's only because we sing it too slow. We milk out every syllable and have a little trouble that way with it sometimes. But some of these backgrounds to these are great. And as we've been talking the other night, you know, you can start to do all kinds of things to make hymn, if you wanted to have a hymn festival, to make it more than just, you know, bearable. You can make them exciting. I was just amazed. I shouldn't have been, because, you know, it happens everywhere. But I'm always still amazed at the number of people who will come up to me, and I'm delighted they do, and say after, gee, I never knew you could take this tune and put it with that work. Hey, that's fantastic. You know why? I even like it now. You know, you never liked Stand Up for Jesus before that tune. You know, but, you know, when you sing Stand Up for Jesus to Lancashire, you know. Exactly. Why, it makes an entirely different idea. It sounds much, much different. And it oftentimes, the big thing it does, and the reason that I do it, is that it shakes people out of the lethargy of singing the same words to the same tune. Now, there are some that are already fine, and I would never want to tamper with them, because they're just unending in interest. There's always something there. Oh, God, our help in ages past, for instance. It just fits so well. But there are a lot of them that you can do a lot of variation with, and you should. The only problem with that, is, you know, in one's enthusiasm to do it, one must be very careful that the person who puts them together is somebody who does know how to sing, and so you know that they fit. That's always the tragedy. I've seen a few times people got overexcited and put them together and they don't quite work, you know. They may be exactly the same meter, but still something doesn't work right because one started on an upbeat and the next one starts on a downbeat, and then you try to put them together and you wonder why they don't work. So you have to be very careful about that. Looking back, just so you are aware, on hymn 15 where we were, basically at the top you always, and on the left have the tune name, and you have next to it the meter. In this case it's common meter. You say, how do you derive common meter? Well, you can count out the syllables of the first verse and you'll have it. You know, joy to the world, the Lord is come. 8, let earth receive her king. You know, 8-6 for that line, and you'll go through. And when you have figured out what the meter is for that hymn, that will be the same meter whenever you see a common meter hymn in this hymnal. Always. It will never vary. When it says irregular, like across the page, it just means that the meter is an irregular one that does not fit any other pattern in the book. And there are certain patterns that we make up when we do a song, like common meter, and then we have some that are not long meter, common meter, or short meter, but that are very standardly used. For instance, 6-5-6-5 double is a very common one, which just means that the syllables are 6-5-6-5, and then just double, and then do the whole procedure all over again. And there's a lot of them that are that way, but when it becomes irregular and it doesn't duplicate itself anywhere in the hymnal, then you just put irregular and leave it at that. Don't try to match up two irregulars, by the way. Oh, that's all. Well, you know, someone in their zeal, I can see moving ahead here. Oh, here's another irregular. All together, it doesn't work. Doesn't work at all. But these kinds of things, and then anything to do with the words is always at the bottom. One of the things that's missing from this hymnal is a meter directory. All of the common meters should have been put together as they were in the old hymnal. That was left out, and that's really a problem to, shall we call it, creative hymn singing. Because it's really, friends, a time problem if you're like this. You know, last night in the service when Carol said, Phil will now look for a new meter, new tune to fit that one hymn that we sang before the, right after the sermon. Well, I did. I looked through the whole hymnal, but I looked page by page. There doesn't happen to be a duplication of that one. But, you know, it was just, you know, like this. There is no, you know, I should be able in 1 second to go, you know. And that's one thing that's really missing. That's a stifling effect when you want to do hymns, because it does take time. Yes.
Is that in that little supplement?
Did they put it in the supplement?
Different types of indices for the hymnal?
It's not. The easiest way I've been able, while I'm up here, as a matter of fact, to prepare for organ vespers when I wanted to do this and save myself a little time is that there's a Missouri Synod hymnal, and they still have it, thank you. So you go there and you can find some of the tunes that are, you know, available. Basically, that's, you know, the material you've got to work with. And I think that there's such a wealth in this particular hymnal that doesn't get used and that could be used, that I think, you know, we've got a long way to go. There are a lot of things that aren't here, and I'm glad to see the little supplements that do come out with new tunes, new materials. But the basic book that's here already has so much more than any church I know of has ever made use of. And that's just based because we end up using a few same tunes. You know, I love the tune Duke Street. But when it has to be used for 5 hymns in one hymnal, there's something, you know, a little wrong. Why couldn't it get used for 1 or 2, the original and 1 more maybe, and then find some other tunes? The same thing is true of Palace Canon. Oh, I mean, that's wonderful, you know. For 6 or 8 hymns, you have to keep finding Palace Canon when you turn. And you go, well, we'll make a switch. That's an easy one to use another tune to. You can, you know, go all kinds of ways with it. None of that is difficult. It's all, you know, it's all right there, and it's all something that anybody can just sit there and figure out. And there it is. Well, yeah, now, do you have any questions about the hymn? Yeah. Number of syllables. Don't count notes, because you might have like a chant where you've got 2 notes. You go, you know, no, that has to do with just syllables.
Syllables in the heart, you know.
Joy to the world, the Lord is come. That phrase. Yeah, Mary.
What does FM stand for?
Small. Short. Short meter. For, well, find a short meter hymn, and I'll show you. There aren't as many. Here it is. Number three. The advent of our God, our prayers must now employ, and we must meet him on his road. With him the holy joy. 6686. So that it occurs so many times that they always just leave it that way. So there we are.